And we're ready with the last block of the conference, which is Lightning Talks. We'll start with the first Lightning Talk by Jeremy White, spoilers from XDC 2022. Jeremy, the stage is yours.
Great, thank you. So I want to ask, do you guys remember when you could see people face to face? You could shake someone's hand. You could look someone in the eye when you told them just how bad their code was. Well, we're hoping that we get to do that all again a year from now. And obviously, we don't know what's going to happen between now and then, but we have made plans to be able to get together in person. And so myself, my company CodeWeavers, and the Wine Project would like to invite you, the X development community, to join with us in a technical conference. So we, the Wine Project, have long admired the X development community. We depend on your work. We curse you under our breath. And we want to party with you in Minneapolis, Minnesota, the City of Lakes. It's part of the Twin Cities of St. Paul and Minneapolis. And in my completely unbiased opinion, the best place to work, live, and go to a technical conference in the world, particularly in the fall. We will be meeting at the St. Thomas Opus College of Business in their conference facility that is in the heart of downtown Minneapolis with lots of restaurants and bars nearby. We'll all get to go on the world's largest private skyway and get hopelessly lost. It should be a great time. And I want to take a moment to point out the dates, which are October 4th, 5th, and 6th, 2022. I want to give credit to Eric Heiler, whose idea this was, so it's his instigation, and to James Ramey, who actually did all of the legwork putting this together. So I'm just taking credit for their work, which is what CEOs do. And there is a tiny little footnote. We are certainly very aware of COVID, and we are preparing for it. We're allocating extra space so we can pivot as need be, but we're really hoping that we can all be together and have a joyful time together in Minneapolis in a year. I hope to see you then.
Okay, the next talk of the day is going to be Jason Ekstrand and Bas Nieuwenhuizen, who's going to talk about conclusions from BVH building with RADV and NV.
So we had a talk this morning for a couple of hours about the BVH building stuff that we've got at Intel and whether or not we can reuse that for RADV. The end takeaway is good news. It looks like code sharing is going to be possible with some caveats. So one of the things that's unclear is exactly how command stream with control flow is going to work on AMD. Boss has some ideas about how that might work, but his ideas are currently untested and the documentation there is not real great. So if any of the AMD people could throw him some real docs, that'd be appreciated. For some of the ALU stuff that we have to do, because there's some calculations that have to happen on the GPU. On Intel, it's done in the command stream with ALU. RADV might have to kick off a compute shader. Switching over to Node for compiling GRIL files is looking likely, but details are very TBD. And it looks like we're going to have to generalize some things a bit. So AMD does indeed have its own BVH format. This is not something that I knew going into the discussion. And one of the big differences is that their BVH is a 4-area tree instead of the 6-area tree on Intel. So we're going to have to generalize some of the algorithms so they can work on 6-area either size tree. We might have to generalize some of the scratch space calculations, et cetera. And clearly, AMD is going to have a different BVH generation backend. But the code is already fairly well set up for that because Intel's backend, Intel's BVH format is consumed directly by hardware, and we wanted to be able to change that in the future if we needed to. So it's already fairly well designed to be able to take different backends. So it looks like it's possible, but there's a lot of investigation that still needs to happen. The next big step is that somebody on my team needs to actually post what we have so that Boss can start playing with it, because until he has something concrete to work with, it's a little bit harder to come to actual conclusions. So I think that's basically where we left it. Boss, do you have anything to add?
I guess the other thing is, like, obviously we need to figure out the command streamer stuff, like that can happen in parallel. And then hopefully that will, especially when the GRIL code is posted, that will give us a good way to get to move forward.
Okay, I think that's all we had.
Thank you very much. Up next is Carl Herbst with Rust in Mesa.
Okay. Yeah, so I wanted to learn Rust a little bit, so I was trying to investigate how easy it would be to use it inside Mesa directly. So my main goals here was just to learn Rust. And I actually wanted to learn more about OpenCL specification, how that all works, because I was always, you know, looking into Clover, and a lot of things were just, why does it look like that? And I wanted to actually understand by implementing OpenCL how that works out. Like, why was it done this way? So to actually use it inside Mesa, I had to figure out how to use Rust to implement a certain API. And I had to figure out how to, you know, be able to call into already existing Mesa code. And another factor is, like, because we are using Mason inside Mesa, and we don't, you know, can't just use Cargo or something, I had also to investigate how well that works. And Dylan Baker was all quite helpful with that and fixed a few issues or added support for BindGen to actually generate Rust bindings for stuff. So, as I said, BindGen is a tool to generate bindings. So you have a C header file or a lot of them. So you can just generate Rust bindings for that, which includes constants and function definitions and all that kind of stuff. And that's essentially it. So besides that, I just had to write some Rust code. And I have a bunch where the code can be looked into if you really want to. It's a link in a PDF, so you don't have to copy it or something. Current status is I can actually do some OpenCL stuff with it already. So buffer, like reading from buffers, writing to them, copying them already works. There's no compiler integration yet, which is something I'm a little bit scared of, because we have LLVM and then Near as well. And without the, like, I suspect this can be quite complicated, and there are also problems. Like, static inline functions can't be used yet, and Near is using tons of those. So in order to use those, I actually have to, you know, write a library which is just including the code and generate actual functions for that. So I have a object file with all those functions, which, you know, with static inline functions you normally don't have. And I can't use external crates to Mason yet, so this is a little bit annoying, because Rust is easier if you don't have to take, for example, mutable references, and there are a lot of container libraries which give you, for example, a queue or vector or array or something. You don't have to take a mutable reference or to change them, like inserting elements or removing them. Yeah, that's it.
Okay, and the next talk today is going to be Demio Benur with summary of discussions from the multi-tenancy workshop.
So the short answer for the multi-tenancy stuff is that it'd be nice if more people showed up. It turns out that there's a lot of uncertainty and a lot of implementing it the way I'd like to see it implemented is going to be a lot of work, because depending on how it's implemented, it could be as much as n times n for n devices and MOSs. Hopefully, I think it could be reduced to M plus M. But there's also, but still, having to create a whole different driver, a low-level driver, in order to make it minimal enough for hostile multi-tenant use is going to be quite tricky. And also, there's the question of, does the hardware actually support this? Is the hardware robust, for instance, against instruction streams that try to bypass page tables to access memory that they should not be able to access? And that is really tricky, obviously, because I'm not a hardware expert, and so that brings the question of, and so that's still an open question. Also, writing this would require, I mean, obviously it's a lot of work, but I still think it'd be worthwhile if it could somehow be implemented, because the payoffs of secure multi-tenancy on commodity GPUs are enormous. Namely, basically not having to deal with regressions. Like, for instance, CubesOS currently looks like it may be suffering from performance regressions because software rendering is being de-emphasized and reduced to fallback paths. And that's really annoying. And so hopefully if hostile multi-tenancy and commodity GPUs were possible, then it would be really, really nice if that could be done. And it's the libvf.io work might also be helpful if that gets to a point where it's usable on Xen or for instance. And if its attack service is sufficiently low, that means having the emulation outside of the hardware domain. But yeah, it's a hard problem. And I'd still like to get more information about whether it can be done, what it would be involved, and so on. I guess the other, probably the main other. So basically, there's a lot of unresolved questions, and if there's some place that they could be discussed more long term, where there might be some like hardware people who know a lot about hardware who could answer some of them and so on, that'd be awesome.
Okay, thank you very much then. So up next is Matthew Herb with the Xorg Security Bridge of Avatar summary.
Okay, so for this workshop, those are the topics that I had in mind. Mainly, we need more people to help dealing with the Xorg security issues. This was a bit of a failure because at the workshop we were at a maximum of 5 people during the interactive session. I don't know how many people followed the session remotely using the CCC or YouTube, but this makes not many people really wanting to participate. But we will try to fix that by also sending an email for a call to participate to the developers mailing list. We spent some time talking about ongoing security issues, among other the X11 socket person in the middle issue that Demi reported 1.5 year ago, and for which we should really start to try to fix it and move forward, testing the patches that were submitted at that time. We also discussed about some general ways to improve X security by implementing the XCD on the X server side, or other IDs like also bringing some Rust in the code that may attract new people, because it's something that may be interesting and motivating for people who have not yet tried to study the X protocol. It may be a new way to attract more energy there. We also discussed a bit with Benjamin on the way that private issues on GitLab may be used or not to report issues. And currently, the situation until the discussion, the situation was a bit unclear to me. Now we have a bit more understanding, and we will probably create a separate project so that we can have private repositories for the projects to actually test some patches before the security advisories go out and new and the fixed modules are released. And finally, we also discussed a bit about the fact that we need more documentation. For instance, the old and new stuff around Wayland, I'm not sure if it's correctly documented somewhere, what are the security contacts, and if someone would report a vulnerability in libweston or libwl routes to XOR security, maybe we would suffer a bit and struggle a bit to figure out who to forward this to. So we need to generally document the process a bit more. And this can also be useful for package maintainers who may get direct reports about security issues if they don't know how to move forward, how to allocate a CVID, how to do an advisory. We have some documentation existing. We just need to refresh it and make it more visible on the XOR wiki or on a GitLab wiki. That's about it for what we discussed during this workshop. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. Up next is Martin Rukala with notes from the CI workshop.
Okay, so that's a quick summary from the workshop. So we had two main topics, trace-based testing and then kernel testing in CI. So let's start with the trace-based testing. So one of the important findings was that reviewing frames outputs was really hard. Just looking at a single frame, it's hard to notice if there are things missing, like heads or something like this, or just general misrendering. Then the next thing was that the frame check, using checksums of frames, works on some games on very simple outputs. But on modern games, it's becoming impossible. Then so we were discussing about returning to reference frames and then having a way to overlay and say basically at this particular pixel, we have seen that up to that much variance. And this way, if we were to ship the reference frames along with the traces, then we could easily check if the frame that we just generated is valid or not. Then we're also investigating creating this reference frame for all the GPUs and GPU drivers. Rather than saying, hey, it is okay if this for this particular GPU, only these pixels are going to change, but being more generic actually and being, for instance, filtering if it is different on different GPUs, then it's acceptable because from a user point of view, most pixels don't really matter if you're off by one or two on every component. So we'll try to make it somewhat general and just catch big changes and to catch issues that would be a bit less easy to catch, especially in places that change a lot, then we're talking about potentially looking into temporal stability of the frames to avoid having something that might look good in one frame but actually is flickering a lot between frames, and we could catch some issues like this. And so quickly, this is, for instance, a frame that renders the same on all our GPUs, and that's a frame that doesn't. And if we look at where the changes are between the two images from the same with the same driver, then we see basically that anything around geometry is problematic. Although here it's not too much geometry, but you can see that there are changes there. Then, for the GitLab-based kernel testing, developers can start using GitLab for their kernel trees, but we cannot move yet DRM tip and DRM misc because that's too high traffic and too we need to ramp up slowly basically. So let's start with smaller projects like Nuvo already started, and FreeDreno and some others can be added, and hopefully they're gonna pave the way and figure out what works and what doesn't. Code submission is going to be difficult. It has to be somewhat of a hybrid model. We cannot have everyone sending merge requests on GitLab because, well, we cannot expect people outside of the community to connect to our GitLab instance and follow things there. So the proposal was to have the core contributors host the project on GitLab and use MRs to test their codes. Occasional contributors send their patches through the mailing list as usual, and then because we want to make sure that people can outsiders can review the changes, then we would set up GitLab to send notification to the mailing list of the project. We also decided that this was already decided before, but basically storing the GitLab CI.yaml file can be done in upstream. Daniel Vetter and Dave Early were fine with this, so this is very good. That simplifies everything. And that is it.
Okay, and we have one more talk of the day, and that is going to actually probably be me. Okay. So how we did the XR conference 2021 today. So this is how my setup looks like, and looks almost professional, but basically it's not as much as we think. The third screen would be very useful for the mainstreaming setup. The microphone is mounted on Faith. It's not really mounted on anything. It's just like standing there in the shock mount. The second PC is absolutely required for monitoring the stream. And in terms of how everything is set up, this is roughly how we did it. We had two primary setups. One was my box on Arch here and the backup box for Maciej Domotowski's home. Both of these machines were just using OBS Studio for everything. And then we had two machines set up on Hetzner. One was with the Jitsi instance where everyone connected to. The second was the Nginx box with Nginx RTMP forwarding. And that was pretty, pretty cheap because it cost us like €5 in total for the 3 days of the conference. And that forwarded both streams to YouTube and media.cc.de, which was absolutely amazing. Thank you very much for your support this year. It was wonderful. And in terms of how much actual resources those boxes were using, we had about 100% CPU usage on the GTC box during workshops, with about 40 people on those. And about 20% on the Nginx box. So we could make it even cheaper, but it was fine. Okay, so now the part everyone's waiting for, the fuck-ups. Surprisingly few, though. So the primary streaming box had Arch installed, backup had Ubuntu, and font config and FreeType configurations was mismatched, so OBS scenes gets misaligned, and we needed to fix that really, really quickly before the conference started. The RTMP gateway had Nginx with the RTMP module built from sources, and then Ubuntu decided to upgrade itself overnight, and that broke the setup about 10 minutes before we were supposed to go live, which was interesting. The backup setup was used for workshops, so we basically, I thought that we could just enable the Jitsi recording in case we had to switch over the backup to the main talk recording, but I tried the Jitsi recorder today, and it turns out it does not work. So we pretty much went without a backup for 2 days straight. Great fun. And we also had a pretty nice backup placeholder, but we did not get to use it even once. Aside from that, two small social issues. I forgot to lock YouTube comments on day one, and that ended up just about as well as you think. We just had to swing the band hammer a little there. And then trying to keep up and just pay attention to everything that's happening on the stream with the speakers and everything is a bit too much for like 7 hours straight. There needs to be someone to swap out after a few hours. And you know, aside from that, you get stressed, you make more mistakes, those mistakes cause you more stress, and then everything just devolves into slow panic. The first day was hopefully not too bad, as long as you did not see what was happening behind the scenes. It was fine though. Okay, so we did almost everything with free software. So free software, video editors, image editors, pretty much everything. The only exception was the NVIDIA encoder for the actual stream, because that's what I have in my books. If you want to check out the stream assets and the configuration and everything with it, it's on GitHub under this link. It will be updated with everything we made during the conference in 2 or 3 hours. And the videos are now being processed, so it will take a few days, but you can get either the live replays now or the pre-processed and nicely cut up videos in, you know, a week or two. Okay, thank you very much. And that's it for the Lightning Talks. And now it's time for the closing session by Radoslav Schwichtenberg.